And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
I find it fascinating that of all of the articles that Rich Buck and I have written at MarketWatch, the one that has attracted the most comments is entitled, How Time Can Turn $3,000 into $50 Million. And I know from conversations and emails that a lot of people have actually put this strategy to work, which gives me a great deal of satisfaction. And I'm excited for those children and grandchildren, what might happen over the rest of their life. Now, just briefly, what this strategy is about for people who haven't read the article, it's simply gifting, if you will, or putting money aside for a child or a grandchild as close to when they're born as possible, and letting that money compound, investing in a growth mutual fund, no load, of course, indexed, of course. And then when the child begins to have earned income so that they can put some money into a Roth IRA, to take the proceeds, whatever they're worth, and start funding that Roth IRA until the proceeds are gone. And if the investment has done well, again, starting, let's say, at birth, and by the time you invest for the first time at age 18, then theoretically the portfolio will have had a legitimate chance to double one, two, who knows, maybe three times. Depends on the luck of the draw, if you will, but should certainly be worth more than the $3,000. Now, the other way to get virtually the same long-term return is to simply put $365 a year away until the child is 21. And again, with the proceeds, taking advantage of the Roth IRA. Now, for this all to work, the money has to be left in the Roth IRA until the child, let's say, is 65. And at that point, they start to draw down in the write-up 5% a year, and we assume they live until 95. And what is so overwhelming, and it's all about compounding, there's no magic here, what is amazing is that 365, 21 times, or 3,000 once, has the potential of producing about $20 million in retirement distributions and leaving heirs or children in charities some $30 million. So you add those two together, what you lived off of and then what you left, and that's the result of that investment. Now, to get the 365 or the 3,000 to grow and be worth all of that, in the study, assumed a 12% compound rate of return. But in the information that's available through the article, there are some tables that you can link to that would show what is the return at 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11%, as well as the 12%. So my sense is it's certainly possible that not everybody who reads the article takes the time to follow the links. It may be that a lot of their responses are just knee-jerk responses to their sense of what reality of the future is likely to be. But I thought in reading through the comments that there were some opportunities for some good lessons about the market and what it may or may not be. So let me share. I think I've got 10 of them here. And some of them really are my responses to comments, and some are my responses to to questions. And in each case, it is my hope that there's a good lesson in it. Corey wrote, 12% a year, every year without fail. Yeah, right, LOL. This isn't your father's or your grandfather's stock market anymore. Don't think it will be impossible for us to end up like Japan's economy. Whoa, a lot of potential lessons there. First of all, my father's nor my grandfather's stock markets made 12% a year every year. Only Bernie Madoff was able to do that. But the reality is that when we talk about getting 12%, first, let me make sure that for those of you that didn't read the article, let you know, where is 12% a legitimate compound rate of return in the past? And going back 88 years, it turns out that the small cap value index has a legitimate shot at a 12% return. But it doesn't do that every year. We all know that the market bounces all over the place. But the interesting thing is, and I'm going to refer now to that one-time $3,000 investment and what it will be worth, let's say, at age 65, because there's a major change at 65. In essence, what the investor has done, maybe the parent, the grandparent, they've made a lump sum investment of $3,000. Never going to add any money. Yes, the money will be transitioned over into the IRA, but it's still the same investment. There's no additional money being put in. There's no money being taken out. And here's what we know. It doesn't matter when the returns, the high returns come, when the low returns come, because the sequence on a lump sum investment for that first 65 years has no impact on the compound rate of return. Now, certainly the returns that you get will have an impact, but it doesn't matter whether the good returns come in the early years, the middle years, or the late years. And the same with the losses. On the other hand, when we talk about dollar cost averaging in over that first 21 years, the $365 a year, I can almost guarantee you that there will be a different amount of money there at age 21 than the person who puts the lump sum in of $3,000. Because the $365 a year suggests that some years you're investing when markets are high, some years you're investing when markets are low. But with lump sum, it doesn't matter. A lot of people find that hard to believe because we've heard the idea that you want to worry as you approach retirement about bear markets. They can be really harmful. And that's absolutely true, but that's almost always talking about somebody who is investing on an annual basis over a lot of years, and they're approaching retirement. So when you put money in, when you take money out, is going to be impacted significantly with the series, whether it's bad returns early and good returns late, or good returns early and bad returns late. So that $3,000 has the possibility of compounding at 12% in small cap value, but guaranteed it won't be 12% a year. The hope is it will be a 12% compound rate of return. So the other part of this fellow's comment here is, don't think it's not impossible for us to end up like Japan's economy. Well, you know what? It's possible. It's possible early in the process. It's possible late in the process that there could be a catastrophic depression kind of a result. But the fact is, is that luck will have a huge impact on how that investor does, because the person who started investing in 1975 versus the person who started investing, let's say in 1970 even, and picked up all those really cheap shares in the first 4 or 5 years of that decade versus the person who starts in 1975, huge difference at the end of whatever long period of time you want to take into consideration. So that's my response to the fellow who suggested that I had found something that compounds at 12% every year. Number two, and this person is responding to this earlier comment by Corey, and his response is, "While I agree that this isn't your father's market anymore, I'm sure the article is referring to an average of 12% annually over time, not 12% actual return every year without fail." Well, partly right, mostly right. But he did make, or she did make, one very serious mistake that it can be a trap, because the average rate of return is very different than the compound rate of return. So let me give you an example. If the first year you invest $100, the first year it goes up 50%. The second year it goes down 50%. What is the average rate of return? Well, the average rate of return is zero. Up 50, down 50. Average, zero. On the other hand, if you put money to work and the first year it goes up 50%, your $100 goes to $150. If the second year it goes down 50%, your $150 goes back down to $75. So you actually have a negative compound rate of return of about 12% versus an average rate of return of zero. There is a very famous radio financial guy who has for years been on the hot seat with investment advisors who have said that his information is so misleading because he tells investors that with the S&P 500, they should expect an average return of 12%. So if a person, by the way, that's true. Historically, that's true. It's been an average rate of return of 12, but it's been a compound rate of return of 10. So if you were doing some life planning, should you use the 12% or the 10%? Well, I think you know the answer. It's the compound rate of return that really tells the story. Number three, from a Kiernan, who said, simply, do it first, then tell me. Now, what I did, of course, was to tell Kiernan how they could turn $3,000 into $50 million. What Kiernan's comment says is, show me how it can be done, and then I'll be interested. Now, this is actually a fairly important comment that Kiernan made, because what it really says is, prove it, and then I'm willing to do it. The problem is you can't prove it. I can say it was accomplished in the past, but one of the reasons that we can't count on the past, whether I do it looking backward or I did it for the next 20 years, would not tell you anything about the following 20 years. People who wait to see it happen, to see it work, are the very people who have a tendency to be attracted to bull markets when they're very high and everybody's been making money. They're doing it. They're showing it before people jump in. and then you know the other side of that mountain. They then find out the reality is that the fact that they did it doesn't mean anything about the following period. Remember the stories I've shared with you in the past about the surveys that were taken in 1999 when the market for the previous 5 years had compounded at 28%, and the people surveyed believed, because it had just done well, that for the next decade it should compound at 20%. In fact, some of the surveys, people were saying 30%. And that's because it just did it. But that's not the way investing works, which is one of the reasons so few people do well like they could. I mean, they may do okay, but they leave a lot of money on the table waiting for somebody to show them how it can be done. They want to participate. They don't want to look at 80 years worth of documented evidence from the past. That doesn't mean anything. They want to live through those good times. Number four. How can anyone predict a 12% long-term rate of return with everything we know about the U.S. and international economies? Most of us haven't had a real salary increase in decades. Now, and then they go on to list other problems the economy has had. Well, what is interesting to me is that if a person is going to make their decisions based on whether you get a real salary increase or not, suggests to me that you certainly wouldn't want to invest in the market from about, 1981 through the end of 2015? And why would I say that? Because I read so many places that we haven't had a real salary increase. The average salary has not gone up related to what inflation, the impact of inflation. So they haven't had real increases. So if we had known that was going to happen, would we then say, no way am I going to participate in a market where nobody is getting raises? I mean, that's a bad sign for the future. And I could list a whole bunch of other bad things about the society, about the economy. And yet, from 1981 to 2015, the stock market, S&P 500, compounded at 11%, and the small cap value compounded at more. So I'm not sure the fact that we haven't had an increase, I mean, I'm not happy about that for people, and I think the economy would be doing better if they had legitimate increases. But we just can't tell about the future. And one of the interesting things is when we think in terms of how we make money with investments, when you put money in the market, now you don't have to agree with this, it's hotly debated, but I would say more or less, when you put money in the market, more or less you are getting the value of the market at that point. And what is it that will lead to either good returns, mediocre returns, or bad returns for the rest of your life? And here's the secret to investing. The answer is the unknown. The unknowable. Oh, we can jump all over the past and may or may not have confidence and trust in the future based on the past, but that's all we have. We have the past and the now. And so all it will take, well, in fact, as I'm recording this podcast, it is the day that the stock market, well, it's not even closed yet, but it's up about 200 points because of what's going on in Europe. Yeah, maybe it might have been down 200 points if the Fed chairwoman had said something that made people nervous about when interest rates are going up. And that's just a short-term response. Who knows what other things could happen? What if we had some sort of a mass killing But we just had one, didn't we? And even though we just had one and we're struggling with the big debate about guns and the concern about terrorists in our own country, the market is focusing on what's happening in Europe right now, today. And what we focus on today could be then considered for a year, or could be a problem for a decade. Look at the problems that followed 1929, the Depression, for a very long period of time. And yet if somebody invested during that Depression, if they had the money to do that, then those people made out very well in terms of the return on the investment during what were shaky times, very shaky times. So my point is that when we make this commitment to a 95-year strategy, 3,000 to grow until age 65, then start throwing off income until they're 95, and then they pass something on to their heirs. Obviously, it's not going to be like that for everybody. But the outcome is about what happens later, not what we see today. And that is a very difficult aspect of making a commitment to invest, because the tendency is for investors to think about today, not about the future. Number five. Well, this was one of the readers who was following up to another comment about how difficult it would be to get the 12% compound rate of return. And this reader says, it's possible, but very tough, even for those of us who are savvy investors and lovers of finance. If you can't do it full time and keep on the ball, always with few mistakes, it's sure a challenge. Now, here's a person who believes that in order to get that 12%, they have to be smart. They have to be on their toes. See, this is really, as far as I'm concerned, has little to do with being on your toes. It has little to do with being able to do it full time. And the fact is that we may be in the middle of a 50-year period of low returns, period. No one knows. And anyone who pretends to know is simply pulling your leg, or they're suffering from a common malady of thinking they are above average. No, you don't have to do it full time. You don't have to keep your eye on the ball. In fact, the studies show that people who try to keep their eye on the ball make less money than those who simply invest the money and walk away. Obviously, they have to invest their money in something that's going to grow with the economy. So my sense is that if what keeps you from doing this is that you don't think you know enough to do it, I would encourage you to not just read my articles about small cap value. By the way, you don't have to put all the money into a small cap value. You could put some into large cap value. You're not likely to get the same return, but you could do that. You could put some in small cap blend. Again, you'd probably take a small step back, but you could do that. So my view is that you put it on automatic and hope that the next 50 to 100 years produces a relatively good return, very much like the past. And by the way, I should mention that if we look at the past and we break it down into the good times and the bad times, and we looked at a long period of time, and I'm looking at going back to 1928, 88 years of data. Well, the first 44 years included some really tough times, included a depression, included a world war, included other wars and the Cold War. And how did the market do? How did the S&P 500 do? Well, it didn't get the famous 10% everybody talks about as being the expected return. No, it got 9.1%. How did small cap value do? Well, it didn't get the 12% I would have hoped for you, but it got 11%. Then the next 44 years, which includes the crash of 73 and 74, the crash of 1987, the market lost 22% in one day. It includes the huge bear market of 2000 through 2002, the huge bear market of 2007 through 2009. It includes terrible times economically, including many of us waiting for hours to get gas because of the oil shortages. Now, how did people do in that 44-year period? Well, it turns out that the S&P 500 compounded at 10.3. Maybe the difference is we didn't have to go through a depression. So, okay, that gave us an advantage. We didn't have to go through a depression over the last 44 years. Small cap blend, 13.1. Small cap value, 15.6. So small cap value has had a huge advantage over the last 44 years compared to the first 44 years. Number six, I think more than any article I've ever written that this article has created more people writing to say, as in this particular case, this article is so frivolous and misleading. Well, I think I work hard to keep my work from being frivolous and misleading. I think the idea of 12% is very unsettling when people haven't seen that for a long time. But I think it's also important to realize that everything we know about the past is hypothetical. Even the S&P 500, the index that's been tracked back to 1926, I think is the earliest that they've recreated it, is really hypothetical. I believe it was about 1957 that an actual index of 500 companies started, but the committee that decides what companies are going to be on the S&P 500 is going to drive a portion of the returns. It may only be an extra or less half a percent because of the companies that they pick to be on the index or when they pick them. It's not unusual for companies to have had huge runs, increases in their values before the committee decides to put them onto the S&P 500 index. But if you change the committee members, you would probably change the companies they selected to some extent. But it's all hypothetical. And even when we look at so-called real-time results, for example, the Vanguard Wellington Fund, I believe it originally started the fund that then grew to be a Vanguard product, started back in the 20s. And Puritan started back in the 40s. But those track records have little to do with what we know about the relationship between the economy and the market compared to what the thinking about the economy and the market was back in the 20s and back in the 40s. Everything's changed. No day will be the same in terms of the information. Oh, yeah, there'd be lots of days that are the same in terms how far the market is up or down, but the reasons will change significantly. I think it's interesting that If we look at the market in the period of 2000 through 2015, the inflation-adjusted return of the index was 1.2%. And the inflation-adjusted return from 1928 to 1938, a terrible time, was 1.1%. And yet, what did they have in common? Nothing but the result after a period of 10 or 15 years. And I think that's the way it'll be in the future. If we made a list of all the things that happened from 1928 to 2015, wars, depression, energy crisis, political crisis, terrorists on our soil, all these things that we are aware of, all the changes in society. But what can we see in the old world? I mean, cell phones today versus what we had then, computers today versus what we had then, cars that will drive versus what we had then. What do those periods have in common? Well, the market was responding to the news of the day, and the market goes up and down and looks a lot today like it did then. Question 7. I'm setting up an account for my one-year-old. It means I'll be putting away money for his retirement rather than his education. My husband and I talked a long time to come to this decision. We also spent a lot of time considering where to put the money. While small cap value seems to be the best place, we are concerned about not having enough diversification. What further diversification do you suggest that will not hurt the returns too much? Now, that's a great question. First of all, I think it would be worthwhile to read some of the articles that I've written about small cap value. It may seem like a high risk investment, but if the market continues to go up over the next 50 years, I don't mean it has to be huge returns, but up. If the last 80 years looks anything like the next 80 years, what we know is that the S&P 500 lost money in 20 calendar years. Now, you might want to know, how did small cap value do in those same years? Well, it turned out the S&P 500 on average lost 12.1%, whereas the small cap value index averaged 9.2% loss in those same years. Small cap value actually lost less. On the other hand, I mean, this is not a miracle. It's not always going to be better. But there were 4 years in which the S&P 500 made money that the value index lost money. In fact, there were seven calendar years. And the average loss was 6.6. In those same years, the S&P 500 made 7.3. So one thing we see about this is that they don't go up and down together. When the S&P does go down, small cap value might do about the same. Sometimes the S&P 500 will go down and small cap value will go up, and sometimes small cap value will go down, the S&P 500 will go up. But what seems to be important here is that they do generally go up together, but when they go up, small cap value tends to do better. Now, what could you do beyond small cap value? Well, you could have some small cap blend, which would mean that you would add some growth to the portfolio. You could add large cap value. Large cap value, if we look at the last 44 years, large cap value compounded at 13.2. Small cap value at 15.6. But in the period from 1928 to 71, large cap value compounded at 9, while small cap value compounded at 11. But large cap value is a possibility. In the coming weeks, hopefully not months, but my goal is in the coming weeks, I'll show you the returns of an all value, small and large, U.S. international, even have a slice of emerging markets value in the portfolio. And that might be the very thing that you'll want to do over time, is to build a diversified value portfolio. Based on history, that would be a smart thing. I believe that Warren Buffett would probably like that idea. Number 8. In an earlier article, you recommended putting money into a crummy trust for your grandchildren. How does this Roth IRA approach compare to the crummy trust using variable annuities? Well, if I had it to do all over again, I would probably have used the $10,000 that I put away for each of our grandchildren. I would have put it into an account that would have been transferred into Roth IRAs rather than using the variable annuities. The crummy trust is special because you can actually dictate when the child will get their hands on the money or just a portion of the money. In my particular case, the children get to start taking out 5% when they reach age 65. But it will be taxable. In fact, it will be taxable under today's tax laws at the highest tax rate, highest marginal tax rate that you have at that time. And I know, for example, when I came into the business back in 1966, the highest marginal tax rate was 70%. So there are a lot of tax implications about the variable annuity that I don't like. I do like it that I can keep their hands off it for 65 years. And hope they make, and the trustee makes good decisions at that point. But if you had children or grandchildren that you could actually trust to leave it in their growing, think of the amazing ability to grow it tax-free and then take distributions tax-free. It is possible that $10,000 invested when a child is born could, at age 65, grow to be worth $10 million. And let's say you take out 5% or $500,000. Well, if that's fully taxable at your highest rate, compare how much you have left to that of a tax-free distribution. So it's a tax question, it's a human nature question, but if I had to do it again, I think I would go the route of putting money away for the Roths and then working hard to educate the grandchildren or the children to do the right thing when the time came. And that is to keep your hands off that money. Number 9. So this is doable if you have 95 years to invest. But let's work with something more realistic, like half that number. Well, actually, if you dig into the tables, you will find the returns at half the number. The returns are there from 4 to 12%. And you can see not only, by the way, the impact at 4 to 12%, but in another table, you can even see the impact of inflation. And what does tend to take the wind out of your sails when it seems like this $50 million is growing to the sky? I mean, it's this original investment of $3,000 worth $50 million. When you inflation adjust that, it turns out that what you have is a lot less than what you would like to have, because I've often talked about when I first came into the industry in the mid-60s, and most young people had a dream that someday they would like $1 million. Young people still have that dream. They think if they had $1 million, they'd be in really great shape. The fact is, if $1 million were the right number in 1966, today that number should be $5 million to make the adjustment for inflation. So the reality is that the big numbers are not what they seem when you start buying stuff 65 years from now. And so to the extent that you kind of throw in the towel and you decide to build a portfolio that would get you 6%, now you not only have the impact of inflation, but you also have the impact of a lower compound rate of return. I would never invest to get 6% for a young person. I certainly can't say what return you'll get if you go for small cap value or large cap value or even the S&P 500. But I've got a table built right there so you can compare not only the returns from 4 to 12 before inflation, but 4 to 12 after inflation. Number 10, is there a point you would start adding bonds to the portfolio? I love that question, because should this $3,000 to $50 million be compromised for, in essence, putting the money into a target date fund? Because if Vanguard had a target date fund for a newborn child, so that it would be theoretically a 2080, let's just, for the sake of discussion, it'd be a 2080 retirement fund. Well, the first thing they would do is they would fill it up with equities, and they might even put 10% in bonds. They do that for a 20-year-old, and it just drives me nuts that they do that, because there's no practical purpose for the bonds other than people can say, I have some bonds in my portfolio, but the expected return is less than 5%. And the expected return for equities is typically about 7% over inflation. Inflation has been about 3% over a long period of time. So it may be that inflation will drive whatever return we end up having over the next 50 to 100 years. So if you set up a target date fund, then what Vanguard would do is they'd have the equity part, mostly large cap growth U.S. and large cap growth international. They'd have a little slice of emerging markets in there. They'd have a very little slice of small cap, and certainly an even smaller amount of small cap value. You might end up with 3% of the portfolio in small cap value if you did it the Vanguard way. But does it make sense that for the first 40 years you stay all equities, and then for the 25 years before retirement, maybe you start adding 5% every 5 years into fixed income? Now, that's going to have a huge impact on what you'll have at age 65, because at that point, the portfolio is going to have grown to be relatively large. If you stay committed to the all equity, small cap value, there's a legitimate shot of having almost $5 million in the portfolio. Don't know the exact number, but it might end up being half of that if you compromise it with fixed income. And it certainly then would tame the portfolio during the period of distribution. There's a part of me that feels like this is an opportunity to put money that has the return likelihood of a small business. I have from time to time talked about having invested $15,000 in a business that grew at 30% a year for 30 years. Well, that $15,000 was what I put into my own business. And it did grow at over 30% over 30 years. A very fine return. And that's after I was paid for the work that I did. So I got paid for working, and I got paid for the intelligence of setting up the business. Now, what did I do when I turned almost 70? I cashed out. It would not be so different, I guess, than the person who has all their money in small cap value, and they turn age something or other, 65 or 70, and maybe they take all that money and put it into an annuity. I didn't do that, but I did put it into a portfolio that's basically half stocks and half bonds for the rest of our life. So I chickened out. The difference being, and the reason I could justify the concept of staying committed to the equities, is that my money was invested in a totally illiquid company that, in order to sell it, it's not a public company, it's a private company. So you have to find that needle in the haystack that wants to purchase an investment advisory company, and a good size one on top of that, which even narrows the size of the market more. So could I justify, what would be the sales pitch that I would use to try to get you to convince your children or grandchildren that they maintain that position? Well, you could take this approach that it is legitimate that people have been told that a smart thing to do is to put money in some great companies and just put them in the safety deposit box and let them grow. And then when the day comes that you need to take money out to live on, sell enough each year to live on. But keep those great companies. Now, the strange thing about small cap value is, as a portfolio of 1,000 companies or 600 companies or 2,000 companies, depending on which small cap index you may get into, those huge portfolios in terms of numbers of companies are probably no more risky than having a couple of really great companies. And by the way, there's a high probability that what you think is a great company will turn out to be maybe an Enron or Sears. I mean, Sears was a model citizen, corporate citizen, for employees and for the stock market. And then it turned out not to be so valuable anymore. And that's not uncommon. And so in some ways, it may even be that a person could make a case that it is less risky to put that certificate, if they did that anymore, for the small cap value index in the lockbox and not touch it. And when you need some, take it out. Now, what I'm hoping that out of this experience and knowledge about small cap value and other asset classes, that when I was 21, I didn't know about these things, but maybe we're going to have a chance to educate our young people. They are going to be savers, maybe not right out of the gate, but eventually. And while this position that we've created with this $3,000 may be too much to have in essence one investment, it may be if your child or grandchild's done a good job of investing on their own, that this is just a very, very thick icing on the cake. So, who knows? Obviously, it's going to be up to your child or grandchild to make this decision long after most of us are gone. So, I hope that's of some help. I'm hoping that this conversation I'm trying to have with you will help you get over the hump of trusting the market, help you get over the hump of thinking that even if you are going to invest for a child or a grandchild, that you will choose something less aggressive. And I think it's also an interesting debate, like this one person mentioned, that the husband and wife are talking about, is this where we should be putting our money? Should we be putting this $3,000 or $365 a year for 21 years? Should we be putting that away for college, or should we be putting it away for something that's going to be used in 65 years? Well, I suspect that that investment you make of $3,000 or $365 is going to pay off as well as the university experience. And I suspect I'm just finishing the last children now from age 50 to 21. Finally, all four of them going to be out of college. And that $3,000 that I might have put away 21 years ago, or $365 a year, seems like a pittance compared to what it ended up costing. I hope this helps. I wish you all well. I hope you keep emailing me and asking me questions. This is a major effort for me. And I also hope you will share it with others. The idea. Thanks for listening.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.